Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Ragnarok by C. Gockel. Narrated by Barry Krynick. Chapter 1. Amy Lewis is a woman at war with her brain. She is riding on a makeshift sled of branches and duct tape. The sled is hitched to the back of a stealth bomber equivalent of a snowmobile and is racing over the ice of Lake Ballstead in Jotunheim, land of the frost giants. The lake is filled with man-eating, claw-flippered, horned orcas that will pop out and eat anything or anyone who stops too long. Amy is stranded here with unlikely company. Her grandmother Beatrice, Bodhi Patel, Steve Rogers, his daughter Claire, an elite military team, the frost giantess Gerth, and Loki's family, his ex-wife Sigyn, and their sons, Vali and Nari. Amy's dog Fenrir and her spider mouse Mr. Squeakers are also with her. Odin blew up the world gate to Chicago during what should have been a short exploratory mission. Without a way home, they're making a break for the Iron Wood, hoping the frost giants there will be friendly. If the whales don't get them, Odin will, and if Odin doesn't get them, Jotunheim's winter will, unless they get to the Iron Wood in time. Terror should be enough to keep her awake. Still, Amy's fighting the urge to fall back on the gear behind her and go to sleep. If she falls asleep, she will roll off the sled. If she rolls off the sled, she will die. But if she dies, she will be asleep. Amy shakes her head and sits up with a start. Last time her brain hopped on that train of thought, she wound up running her car off the road. Her obviously traitorous brain whispers, "But that was all because of Loki. There's no Loki here. It's safe to rest your eyes for a moment." Her eyelids start to droop, and then the nearly silent hybrid snowmobile pulling the sled hits a snowbank. Amy feels the sensation of weightlessness as she is briefly airborne, and then the sled lands hard. Her joints scream, and she fights back a groan. She doesn't remember the ride hurting when they started this journey. Why does she feel so stiff and achy now? She takes a long breath and reaches to take off her hat. Even with the wind whipping against her back and the cold sled beneath her butt, she feels hot. She stops herself, mentally cataloging her symptoms: pain in joints, fever, and exhaustion. Carefully, she reaches to touch the lymph nodes in her neck with her mittened hands and finds them tender and sore. Awesome. She's picked the perfect time to catch a cold. She looks out at the other snowmobiles. Everyone seems to be sitting up and alert. Admittedly, she can't see anyone's face, and the only person she can identify is the frost giantess Gerth. Gerth's magic makes her infinitely desirable to any man who looks at her. To protect the men on the team, she's wearing a magic-blocking cap and bracelets. The cap is visible just between her hood and her goggles, and it's glinting faintly in the starlight. Gerth has been a captive of the U.S. government for many years. The exploratory mission was to prepare for a larger expedition to return Gerth to her people, and to open up weapons trading with the frost giants. Amy sniffles. Of course she would get a cold. She is the weakest link in the chain. Her eyes shift to Bodhi sitting with his back to her on the tail of the sled. He's not supposed to be here. Well, even less than she's supposed to be here. Bodhi, Claire, and Amy's grandmother had followed them to warn Amy, Steve, and the team Steve was leading that Odin was on to their exploratory mission. She can't see Bodhi's face, but she can see the tip of the rifle he has balanced on his knees. No one had offered Amy a rifle, because she can't shoot and probably could even miss one of the giant man-eating orcas if it was charging right at her. Bodhi could probably improvise a weapon with his hat and kill one in a single strike. She's glad he's sharing the sled with her. It's good to have someone on her side besides Beatrice and Fenrir. Some of the special ops guys don't exactly trust her. Amy just found out a few hours ago her code name among the military top secret types is Pandora, after the woman in Greek mythology who let all the evil loose in the world. She smiles ruefully to herself. They don't know how appropriate the pseudonym is. Amy made a serum that makes humans magical. She gave some to Steve to cure his paralysis. The government stole most of the remainder and gave it to the SEAL team. What they don't know is that she made the magical serum contagious and that it's already spreading on Earth. Bodhi, the only person who knows, thinks she's saved humanity. She bites her lip. She knows he's wrong. The serum is untested. It could wind up a plague. Her eyes slide to her dog Fenrir sitting at the front of the sled, nose lifted to the wind. Her once tiny, nearly furless mutt got the serum and is now turning into an enormous wolf, thankfully with a thick, luxurious coat. It is a transformation that suits Fenrir fine, but for humans would be unpleasant. She swallows. And magic development in utero, if excessive, can lead to miscarriages. That's how her own child died. She may have condemned countless women to the same experience she had. After she told him all of that, Bodhi kissed her forehead and said, "Amy, the only way you are like Pandora is that you saved hope." The memory is terrifying, because he said it with the same conviction someone might say, "I love you." Or maybe that's just what her brain wants to believe. Bodhi is a great guy. He wouldn't leave anyone to be eaten by spiders or Adza, or to become Odin's latest pet. But he's also not that guy. He's not ready for commitment. She rubs her temple. In fact, right before they'd left Chicago, he'd had a one-night stand. Sometimes he flirts with her, but he flirts with everyone. The best thing for her to do is to take it with a smile and a laugh. With his back to her, Bodhi suddenly sits up straight. Amy is about to ask him if he's seen something when he slumps backward. His head lands on her lap, eyes closed, rifle still in a death grip. Amy looks out over the ice. Nothing is moving. She hears nothing. She looks down at Bodhi. Flicking up her radio headpiece so she can't be heard by the team, she whispers, "Okay, that's very funny." They're not supposed to talk. They're trying to keep their trip over the lake as silent as possible so the man-eating whales don't pop up for a snack. He doesn't move. His head lolls slightly to the side. He looks like a marshmallow person in all his winter gear. The only part of him that looks human is his dark skin between his muffler and his cap. She holds her breath. Any moment he's going to open his eyes, grin, and say, "Beautiful night for a sleigh ride." And she'll flush, because she's beginning to worry, even though he's obviously playing a joke on her. She should say something witty and clever, and he'll laugh. She glances to the pocket of his parka and sees the top of a package of cigarettes. Trying to keep her tone playful, she leans forward and whispers, "If you don't sit up, I'm going to throw your cigarettes out on the ice." Bodhi doesn't move. Amy resists the urge to scream. Instead, she rips off a mitten with her teeth and presses her hand to his forehead. He's burning up. She feels a rising wave of panic. She squashes it, just like she would in the operating room. Flicking her headpiece radio back into place, she says slowly and clearly, "Captain Rogers, Bodhi Patel has a fever. I'd guess at least 104 degrees. He just passed out. I want to check in and make sure no one else is getting sick." There is a pause, and then Steve says,
"Dr. Lewis, I feel fine. But agreed, we need a check-in. Team report."
One by one, all of the special ops team, Gareth, Sigyn, Nari, and Vali, check in. They all feel fine. Amy's brow furrows. "Grandma, how are you feeling?"
Beatrice doesn't answer.
Amy is about to turn around and look, but then a flash of black catches her eye. Her mouth falls as she digests what she's seeing. "Captain, Claire is slumping." Fenrir barks, the sled careens wildly, and Amy, Bodhi, and Fenrir go rolling into the snow. Steve barely has time for Lewis's words to sink in before the mutt barks and he hears muffled thuds break the eerie silence of the Jotunheim night. And then he feels Claire slumping against his back, and Lewis's voice is crackling in his ear again, cold and calm. "We're overboard, but all right."
"All halt,"
Steve orders, his heart racing. He barely hears them as they slide to a stop. The winter gear the team wears is as high-tech as the vehicles, and even when Steve catches glimpses of them, it's hard to tell who is who. Their gear covers them from head to toe. Through his green-tinted night-vision goggles, Steve just barely makes out Lieutenant Larson's snowmobile, distinguishable because it is a two-seater with a sled attached to the back that Amy's mutt is sitting on. The doctor and Bodhi should be on the sled, too. The vehicle has veered off course by nearly 90 degrees.
In the passenger seat, Beatrice is bent over sideways, held on only by her seatbelt. Her weight is probably what caused Larson to swerve. Steve's attention returns to his own passenger.
Claire?
He says. He gets no response. Unlike some of the snowmobiles, Steve's is a one-person vehicle, but his 10-year-old daughter, Claire, is so slight she fit behind him with room to spare. They'd used bungee cords to strap her to him. They may have saved her life. Now if he moves, he will pitch his daughter into the snow.
Claire?
He says again. Her silence fills him with a panic greater than thoughts of man-eating orcas.
I've got Bodhi, Lewis says. I can pull him onto the sled.
We don't have any more bungee cords, says one of the guys. Should we take some off the gear?
No,
says Warrant Officer Harding, one of the two female Marines on the team.
We've got duct tape.
Use it, says Steve.
A moment later, Harding is running toward them. She's the easiest to recognize in all her gear. Harding's the smallest, but she moves with a lot of power despite her size. Beneath them, the ice groans.
Over the radio, someone's voice cracks. Bogey's underneath us.
Behind Steve, Harding whispers,
Sir, she's very hot.
Her voice shakes. Steve knows it's not because she hasn't seen men and women in worse situations, but Claire's a kid, and a sick kid just sucks at your heart.
Just move as fast as you can, Marine,
Steve says, lifting his arms to give the woman room. Harding begins taping Claire to Steve. Over the radio, Warrant Officer Berry's voice crackles.
There's a thermal vent in the ice at 10 o'clock, about 85 meters away.
Thermal vents are where the whales congregate and come up to breathe. Steve's team can't stay in one place on the ice for very long. They need an island away from the whales and a safer place to check out their teammates. He glances over at Berry. The short, stocky man is standing on the back seat of one of the double-seaters, binoculars in his hand. Berry is a warrant officer with a specialty in tactics. He is part of the original SEAL team, unlike Warrant Officer Harding, who is a Marine on loan. Because of his experience, Berry probably commands more respect among the men than Steve or Larson, though technically they outrank him. Berry's voice cracks in his ear.
There is an island about two clicks away at 2 o'clock. We can stop there.
Exactly what Steve needed to hear. Scanning the lake, he just barely makes out a jagged rise covered by wicked-looking black trees.
Done, sir, says Harding, patting his side.
Beatrice is secure, says Larson.
Fenrir starts to growl. The ice below Steve groans.
Get to your vehicle, Marine.
Revving his engine, Steve shouts,
They know we're here. Everyone head to the island. Combustion engines on.
The words are barely out of his mouth when the ice between Steve and Harding explodes and a giant white-horned whale breaches the surface. Harding leaps onto her machine, but the beast spins and lunges toward her snowmobile. Before Steve can swing his rifle around, it slides toward Harding, propelling itself with talons attached to its flippers. She guns the engine, but the whale grabs the gear loaded onto the back, swings its head, and Harding and the snowmobile go flying through the air. Steve speeds toward Harding, and her life flashes before his eyes. He'd insisted that she be on this journey because they needed at least two team members with combat training and winter survival skills who wouldn't be affected by Garrett's glamour. Harding is all that and is a warrant officer with a specialty in communications, but she's so damn small. He sees her rolling through the snow and his gut wrenches. She has to be stunned. Just as he thinks that, she springs up, covered in snow, rifle on her back.
Get on,
he shouts, sliding to a halt just beyond her. He feels the snowmobile sink behind him, and Harding shouts,
Go, go, go!
He hits the gas, and they jerk forward. The whale lets loose a bugle that makes every hair on the back of his neck stand on end. Steve feels Harding grabbing his parka and has to lean forward to keep from slipping backward. She must be sitting on the sloped area of metal just behind the seat. It won't be easy for her to stay on. He hears another bugling sound behind him and another crack of ice. An instant later, he sees another whale bobbing across the snow and ice in front of him. The snowmobile he's on can reach speeds of 150 miles per hour when it's not in stealth mode, but that's with one rider, not with three.
Hold on,
he shouts.
Hitting the gas, he swings around the new whale in a wide arc, and then hears a ripping noise and prays it isn't his parka. Someone's voice cracks over the shared frequency.
2 more bogeys, 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock.
10, 2 o'clock, and 2 more at 6 o'clock? Something in Steve's mind sparks. He sees his teammates as though suspended in slow motion, like he is just an observer behind glass. Suddenly, he knows what is about to happen.
"Prepare for incoming 12 o'clock,
he says, veering his own snowmobile to the left. He hears the ice explode exactly where he thought it would. Someone shouts, and there is the roar of one of the snowmobile's forward guns. The whale at 10 o'clock lunges toward Steve's vehicle. The whale at 12 o'clock does likewise, probably picking the straining one-seater as the weakest target in the herd. Harding swears. The whale at 10 o'clock collides with the tail of the snowmobile, and they go skidding toward the whale at 12 o'clock, furiously clawing its way onto the ice. Steve turns into the skid and throws down a leg, barely managing to keep his snowmobile upright. Before they come to a stop, Steve hits the gas, and the overloaded vehicle strains forward. Over the engine, he hears the ripping sound again, and the sound of whale talons clicking on the ice. The ice starts to crumple under them and cracks directly in front of them as the whale behind them tries to haul up its weight. Even gunning the engine, the snowmobile barely moves. He hears a Barrett rifle firing very close, and he feels Claire jolt against his back. Harding whoops,
"Got it!"
There is a splash, the incline flattens out, and the snowmobile shoots forward right over the crack. If they can just keep ahead of the one to their right... A shot rings out. Again, Steve feels recoil, and Harding shouts again,
"Two for me!"
Another shot fires, and Barry's voice crackles,
"Got our friend at 2 o'clock!"
Air rushes out of Steve's lungs. He hadn't even realized he'd been holding his breath. Over the sound of engines and the distant bugle of the one remaining whale, Steve hears Harding chuckle.
"I win."
Steve almost laughs in relief. Shaking his head, he says,
"Marine, how are you holding on?"
"Duct tape."
Over the radio, he hears someone laugh.
"You can't see her, Captain. She's taped herself on side saddle."
Steve almost smiles, but then he feels Claire's head slip lower behind him. He's soaked with sweat beneath his gear. Still, he shivers. Amy gulps as they clear the whales. At the front of the sled, Fenrir has stopped barking. On the snowmobile, Beatrice is slumped to the side, only in a sitting position because of the duct tape. She looks down at Bodhi passed out in her lap. Putting the rifle next to her, she puts her hand on his forehead. His lashes don't even flutter. Despite his dip in the snow, he's still too hot. He'd gotten deathly ill in Nornheim, too. Amy's been to Nornheim, Asgard, and Alfheim, and this is the only time she's gotten even a tiny bit sick. Her brow furrows. Asgard and Alfheim have had enough recent contact with Earth to explain why she didn't get sick there, but she should have gotten sick in Nornheim like Bodhi. Searing pain flashes behind her eyes. Squeezing them shut, she shakes her head. In Nornheim, Bodhi's lungs had been flooded with water, but not hers. That's why he'd gotten sick. Taking a deep breath, she takes off Bodhi's cap and runs her fingers through his now short hair. She'd done the same in Nornheim. She bites her lip. Bodhi's an unrepentant flirt, a serial bedhopper, and the most dependable friend she's had in a crisis since ever. The sled hits a bump. They are airborne, and their snowmobile lands with teeth-rattling force. Bodhi doesn't even moan. Amy's shoulders slump.
"Don't do this to me, Bodhi," she whispers, dropping her face to his.
His lips split in a wide grin.
"Are you going to kiss me again?"
Amy sits up with a gasp, expecting him to laugh, but his eyes don't even open, and the smile fades away. Amy swallows at the reference to the kiss in Nornheim. It had been part of her ploy to convince him that his mind was stronger than the disease that was killing him, and for a little while it had worked. He's never teased her about that until now. Her brow furrows. Maybe he isn't teasing. Her head hurts and her stomach flutters, but not in a good way. Under usual circumstances, she wouldn't want to kiss anyone feeling like this. Larson must change the snowmobile's course, because the sled slides sideways, and Bodhi nearly rolls off. As they straighten out, Amy adjusts his body as best she can.
He is absolutely silent, his body completely pliable. It's terrifying.
Fenrir gives a little bark. Amy turns her head and sees an island coming up fast. She looks to the side. They're at the back of the snowmobile pack and no one can see. She drops her lips to his and kisses him. He doesn't respond. Not that she expected him to, but maybe she had hoped.
She almost pulls away, but then his lips move softly against hers. It's just relief that makes her press her lips more firmly against his. And then heat floods her, burning away the unease in her stomach and the headache behind her eyes. The power of that heat is so unexpected she jerks away.
Bodhi opens his eyes. She expects another joke, but he just looks up at her with deadly seriousness. It's the same way he'd looked at her when she told him the magic serum is contagious.
"Thank you," he whispers, and then his eyes slip shut.
Closing her eyes, Amy silently wills Bodhi, Beatrice, and Claire to hold on and desperately wishes she knew some way to help them. She blinks in the darkness and looks back at her pack, eyes wide. She does know how to help them.
Putting his feet down on either side of the snowmobile, Steve tears off his hand protection with his teeth and starts ripping off the duct tape strapping his daughter to his back. Harding, loose locks of blonde hair encrusted in snow, bolts off the sled and out of his way. Moments later, he's gathering Claire in his arms, reminding himself there are three magic users on the team and one will know how to make her well. Still, as Steve plows his way to the tent that's already been put up in record time, the first name on his lips is Lewis. A light goes on within the command tent. The doctor pokes her head out.
I know how to help them, she says, drawing back in.
How did he know she would?
Steve strides into the tent. Bodhi and Beatrice are already stretched out on sleeping bags on the floor. Fenrir is sitting at attention beside Beatrice's head. Steve would swear the dog's grown since that morning. She looks to be the size of a small German shepherd, but with outlandishly large paws and head. Members of the SEAL team are milling around. He can read their uncertainty in their furrowed brows and uncharacteristically fidgety stances. They all have advanced emergency trauma training. Any of them would know immediately how to patch up a gunshot wound or set a bone. But this is different. Steve kneels down beside a bag opened for Claire, but doesn't put his daughter down. Instead, he clutches her more tightly to him, resisting the urge to kiss the top of her head.
"Nari and I can offer some aid," says Sigyn, stepping into the tent, her son beside her.
"And I too,"
says Gerth, too quickly, as though she's afraid of being left out. Dropping to her knees beside a pack, Lewis says,
"We should do that, but it will only be a temporary fix, until we get sick again."
Steve looks up at Sigyn. She nods.
"What the doctor says is true."
She swallows.
"And I should say, none of us specialize in medical magic."
Gerith puts her hand on Beatrice's forehead.
"Thor trained long years in biological magic. He can heal you humans in minutes, but not us."
Sighing, she comes over to Steve. She reaches toward Claire, but before she can touch her, Steve draws Claire closer, tucking her head beneath his chin. He doesn't meet Gerd's eyes, and the giantess withdraws. Pulling a rolled article of clothing from her pack, Lewis shakily unwraps it and reveals a plastic first aid kit. Opening it, Lewis exhales in audible relief.
"They aren't frozen."
"What's not frozen?" says Steve.
"We're sick because we're not magical," Lewis says, waving to Bodhi, Beatrice, and Claire.
"But we're not magical either," says Jung Park.
"Yes, you are," says Nari.
Barry's face flushes a deeper shade of red, and he clears his throat.
"We should probably tell them about that, Captain."
"We'll discuss it later," says Lieutenant Larson.
Murmurs rise in the tent. Ignoring them, eyes on Lewis, Steve blinks.
"You're sick, too?"
He takes in her flushed cheeks, her two bright eyes, and her slightly sloppy movements.
"I see," he says. "Why aren't you unconscious like them?"
Lewis sighs.
I'm not as sick for the same reason some people don't get AIDS and some people survive smallpox, cholera, and the Black Death without modern medical care.
She pulls out a hypodermic needle and a test tube. Stabbing the top of the test tube with the needle, she says, "Lucky jeans." Steve feels like his hair has been rubbed the wrong way. She didn't get sick on Nornheim either. He's heard people of European descent have greater resistance to disease. The theory goes that during the Middle Ages, Europe was a cesspool, and those who survived had to have hardy immune systems. His eyes drop to Beatrice. European ancestry can't be the only factor. He has the nagging sense of missing something important, but Claire's body sags hopelessly in his arms, and he pushes the thought away.
"What is that, doctor?"
Lewis taps the air out of the needle.
"The same serum that made all of you magical."
Steve's chin drops, a dark thread of suspicion entering his mind.
"I thought that was confiscated."
"Nope," says Lewis. "I knew they'd do that, so I kept some for Bodhi, Beatrice, and me, so we could get our memories back, and..."
She nearly falls over, clutching her head with one hand. One of the SEALs, Corporal Tucker, drops beside her and puts a hand beneath her elbow. Amy mumbles, "I'm okay, really." Steve's jaw ticks. The serum has given Steve access to memories he hadn't known he had. Loki had wiped out Bodhi's memories when he made him the incarnation of Chaos. Bodhi braved going to another realm to recover them, so of course he would brave an injection of a barely tested drug. He probably convinced Lewis it would be good for her and her grandmother to get the serum, too. Steve exhales. He's furious at the deception, but it was understandable, and maybe now it will save Claire. Steve tilts his head.
"You have enough for all of you?"
Lewis rubs her forehead.
"No, I only have 3 doses."
For a moment, Steve cannot even find the energy to breathe. Lewis continues.
"Enough for my grandmother, Claire, and Bodhi."
Pulling down his muffler, Corporal Tucker says,
"What about you, doctor?"
His blue eyes are on her. A furrow is between his brow, and his hand is still beneath her elbow. Steve tenses. His brain calls up everything he knows about Tucker. Good kid, stable 2-parent home, father a retired factory worker in Kansas. The doctor shrugs.
"I'll be fine. This illness isn't any worse than a nasty cold for me."
She smiles thinly.
"The longer we stay here, the more likely we are to be attacked. My grandmother and Bodhi are as good in a fight as anyone."
Steve hears some harumphs and men clearing their throats in the tent. Lewis doesn't respond to them. Eyes on Steve, her face crumbles.
"And no one is going to give the serum to me when it can be used to save a little girl."
The room falls silent. Steve wills no one to argue, especially Tucker, looking too earnestly at the doctor. It's the choice Steve would have made. Bodhi and Beatrice will be useful when Odin's men attack. And Claire, well, he would always choose Claire. He closes his eyes, gives in, and kisses Claire's head. Beneath his lips, she's too hot, and she smells like fever. She doesn't stir.
"Thank you, doctor," he says.
He opens his eyes, tries to meet hers, and wills her to see his gratitude, but Lewis's eyes are unfocused. Staring at a point on the floor, she says,
"I really need to take a nap. Does anyone here know how to administer an intravenous injection?"
"All of us," says Tucker.
Lewis hands him the needle, walks on her knees over to her grandmother, and falls over.
"Lewis," Steve says.
She waves a hand.
"I'm fine. Like I said, I just need a nap. Best way to let the immune system take over."
Her eyes slip shut.
"Someone check her out,"
Steve says, his heart jumping. "Take care of Lewis," Prometheus had said. Tucker puts his bare hand on Lewis's forehead, looks up at Steve, and shrugs.
"She's only a little hot."
Lewis makes a raspberry noise with her lips, but doesn't open her eyes.
"Nobody listens to me. Sometimes I don't even know why I bother to speak at all."
Steve feels the skin on the back of his neck prickle. There's something about her words. Still holding the needle, Tucker says,
"Sir, should I give your daughter the first injection?"
Steve looks down at Claire, her skin flushed dark. He looks up to Sigyn. She nods. The doctor's logic is sound. Being magical gives an extra boost.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?